Welcome to The Leader's Edge, where we celebrate leadership and shine a light on the visionary leaders that are shaping our future. Hey, I'm H.R. Huntsman, founder of The Leader's Edge, creator of The Leader's Edge Performance Engine and Leader's Edge University. I am thrilled to bring you stories from leaders who are making a difference around the world. In each and every episode, we champion the innovative strategies, courageous decisions, and inspiring journeys of those who lead with purpose and passion. So whether you're looking to refine your leadership skills or you simply want to be inspired, my friend, you are in the right place. On today's show is one of those rare voices in the financial world who's not just disrupting the status quo, he's rebuilding it with intention, clarity, and purpose. By the age of 25, he had already founded his own firm, Legacy Investment Planning, and by 30, he was named one of the top 40 under 40 advisors in the entire nation. But what sets Stan Morgan apart isn't just his accolades, it's the mindset behind his momentum. He's the author of Seven Mindsets of Success and Wish I Knew That Sooner, and he's on a mission to help people avoid financial regret, unlock their full potential, and lead with vision in both life and business. In today's episode, Stan shares some of his filters for investing, keys to mindset success, and some great insights from his three books. Let's jump in with the one and only Stan Morgan. Stan, thank you so much for joining me today on The Leader's Edge. I really appreciate your time, my friend.
Man, I'm excited to be here. I know this was a long time coming, coordinating calendars, so yes, I'm pumped.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. One of your books is Wish I Knew That Sooner. Before you tell us what we should know sooner, I'd love to put that back on you. What do you wish you would have learned sooner?
In business or life?
You pick.
Or those very closely connected.
They're all the same to me. Business.
Yeah, for me, part of my story was I went to an executive retreat once in Scottsdale, and in a part of my life where I feel like I'm having success. I feel like I'm doing all the right things, but the outcome is maybe not what I anticipated. And a takeaway from that retreat was you can serve the world without trying to save it. And I think I wish I would have known sooner that I do play a part. And I think the Lord uses me to help people in business, with my family, with my extended family, but there's only so much I can do. And if I think I'm too important in that story, I might try to take on too much. Gotcha. Into all the lengths I went to help people. And I think manufacture my world so that it stayed predictable and intact. As those things didn't work out as I planned, because of course they involve other people I can't control. Mm-hmm. You ended up being like, wait, what was all this for? Like, I thought I was checking all the boxes. I was pulling all the right levers. And I think that just helped me sit in the tension of the unpredictability of life. And some, a curveball is coming next week, the next week. And instead of living in fear of that, it's when it comes, I think I'm prepared to handle it well. And I think I spent a lot of my life, my journey personally and in business, thinking I had more control over my surroundings than I did.
Very good. So that book is intended for people, you're a financial planner. It's all about financial planning. What do you normally hear from people like us? I wish I knew that sooner. So give us some advice. What should we be learning at a younger age when it comes to financial preparations?
So I became a financial advisor my senior year of college. I started selling insurance. I didn't know what financial advisors really did day to day. It was the only internship that paid me $100 a week to show up. Gotcha. And I was a struggling college athlete financially. So I was like, hey, you pay me $100, I'll show up and check the boxes. And I never thought I'd sell stuff. I wasn't naturally a salesperson. People in my family didn't sell things. I never thought I'd run a business. People in my family didn't run or own businesses. So I stumbled into the business. I took an assessment for this internship that they said, you are perfect for this business. Now I look back 16 years later and I realize that they told everybody that the assessment said that. I was like, oh, I could do it. 8 out of 10 financial advisors don't last 5 years in the business. It's a pretty hard path. And I think part of that is because we're not really given a path. It's join this business and start selling stuff to people, whether it's insurance, investments. And these are good things you're selling. But what I didn't realize is we weren't doing a lot of creative financial planning. Meaning, if I would have met with HR 5 years of my career, I would have tried to sell you investments. And if you would have said, "Hey, Sten, I have a business that's really successful. I just want to pay less taxes and I want to protect my business better and I want to pay less estate tax someday," I couldn't have really helped you because I couldn't sell you a product to do that. And so I needed you to buy my thing in order for me to give you advice. And so when I started Legacy 13 years ago, I said, how do we give people just great financial plans? And they're the financial plans we would do ourselves as financial advisors instead of the only thing I have to sell is insurance. So every time HR needs something, my solution has to be insurance.
Gotcha.
And I think about 90% of our industry is still that way. And so your financial plan, and I meet with people all the time, I could tell probably where your financial advisor works based on what your financial plan looks like. And it doesn't mean it's a bad plan. It just means if your advisor works for an insurance company, I bet insurance is going to be the dominant factor of your plan.
Close.
If your advisor works for a wirehouse or a big investment firm, it's probably going to be pretty dominated by investments. Where a lot of clients we work with now, because we're consultants, a lot of our clients are business owners and they pay us a consulting fee for our advice. It involves real estate, it involves their company. They're probably funding some investments. They probably do own some insurance, but you could look at it, and if you put it up on a whiteboard, you'd say, wow, this feels pretty unbiased. Like it feels really balanced, where I don't think a lot of people's financial plans are very balanced at this point.
See. So what do you think the biggest mistake, let's say people in their 30s and 40s are making when it comes to investment then?
Not having a process. And so a book I'm working on now is how can I take my 17 years of experience seeing so many clients, living in this world of seeing great financial plans to not great financial plans. If I can't live on everybody's shoulder, meaning I'm not on speed dial, when all my clients are trying to make an investment decision on something,
Yeah.
how can I download a process into them that like it's at least forces you to pause before you do something? Because a lot of people, not knowing enough to feel confident on their own, they're going to take advice from a cousin, a buddy at work. And emotionally, you're usually going to get into the thing after you should have. Like all your friends at work are talking about this thing they should have bought. You probably missed it at that point if everyone's talking about it. And so I have a process that I call the investment decision filter. And what essentially is before you ever invest money in anything, real estate, a business, mutual funds, insurance, you need to ask yourself a series of questions to say, okay, do I truly understand this enough to get into it, or am I gambling? And the gambling can work every once in a while, but most people I meet with, and this is where the title of the book, Wish I Knew That Sooner, came in, is that this guy, he was, think of a Albert Einstein kind of slash mad genius guy that had been in the finance industry for 40 years. I got connected with him and he helped me do some of the research for the book. I flew down to Florida and I met him at a Panera Bread a mile from the airport. And we're sitting there. That's where all great books are written, is at Panera Bread, or so I hear. And we were talking about it. And I was like, I just don't know what the title is going to be. And he's like, you've already said the title like five times today. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, no, you've told me that when you sit with people, the most often what you hear from them is, I wish I would have known that sooner. Like, why didn't somebody tell me that?
Yeah.
I have a CPA, I have a financial advisor, but so many of the things you're telling me, I've never heard of before. Why is that? And so the complexity of the tax code, of our financial systems, the busyness of all of our lives, I think these are areas of resistance that try to hold us back from having a great financial plan. Life is never going to be just still. Like busyness is something we have to fight with. The complexity is always going to come. We're going to think we figured out the tax code and then they're going to change it on us. But if we can all have a system, like a personal system we get to carry around with us that helps us make better choices,
Okay.
that's the ultimate goal.
Let's make this super practical. As we speak, I am in the due diligence process of purchasing an electrical company. This is for real. Question: should I, other people be watching this podcast, listening to this podcast, they're going to be thinking about owning a business. What questions, top three questions, should I be asking right now? Really
Great
practical.
question. All right. So here's the filters first. So the
Okay, good.
filters are this. Every time you want to make an investment of any kind, this isn't just mutual funds, it's a business like you're talking about. It could be a piece of real estate. You always want to factor all these things in. So the first one is risk. One, does it fit my risk profile? That's a pretty standard question. But the question under that question is, do I even understand the risk that exists here? And so when you buy a business, there's complexity to that because you're trying to really figure out like, does this business run on its own? Is there key man risk? Is there single channel risk? Do they get all their business from one area?
Sure.
And so there's a few questions probably under each category, but the first one would be risk.
Okay.
I would challenge you and say, HR, convince me that you understand all of the risk that's associated with this investment.
Okay.
And
Okay.
if you're like, the books look pretty good, I'd be like, okay, that's good, but I'm not getting that you've actually sat in the risk long enough to explain it to me in detail.
Gotcha.
The next is performance. A lot of times people make a decision based on past performance and they don't really say, okay, what's the performance going to look like in the future? And there's a term called asymmetric risk, which means, and this is, I read this in a book a while ago. I think it was one of Tony Robbins' books called Unshakable. The most successful people in finance, when they make an investment decision, they don't make a choice that has a 50-50 odds of working out because you're rolling dice. They want to invest in something that's a higher probability of success. And a lot of like hedge fund managers or people that buy and sell companies, they want asymmetrically that there's like a 5x chance of them winning over losing. What that means is that it's okay if one of your businesses goes bankrupt because you have four other ones that are going to do great.
Gotcha.
So the odds should always fall in your favor. So when you're evaluating performance, it's not, hey, I think this is going to work out. It's no, I've done the research and there's a really good chance this is going to work out.
Okay, very good.
The next filter is taxes. What is the net tax effect of this investment? There's people that can make really inefficient investment choices, and you think you're going to make 20%, but net of taxes, you made 10. And so taxes should always, we don't want taxes to dominate the conversation, but we should always think about it.
Okay.
And then you want to think about fees. What is the expense of making this investment work? Is there an ongoing investment expense? We don't want the fee conversation, which I think people do at times, is, oh, that's too expensive. Most of us, if I said HR, you can make 20% a year, but it's going to cost you 2% a year. You'd probably say, okay, where do I sign?
Sure.
So fees are an issue in the absence of value. The final one, and for your particular case, I would spend a lot of time on is time. You could pass all of those four previous filters, risk, performance, taxes, fees, but if you do not have the time and energy to watch this investment and help it be successful, you shouldn't even start it from there.
That's good.
And so those are the filters. Obviously, there's questions underneath each one of those, but if you can walk yourself through a process every time, the greatest gift you can give yourself in investing is saying no to more things than you say yes to.
Okay.
Where most people that I meet with, and these are very successful people you can think of, worth hundreds of millions, some even some billionaires, some of their worst decisions were like, I rushed into that thing. I got a little overconfident. I trusted something too much and I deviated from the process that had got me where I wanted to go. And so for everybody listening, if you're thinking, Sten's talking about some process, I don't have a process. Like I use my gut. Or I just hope it works out. The gift you can give yourself is coming up with something that causes you to pause before you make an investment choice. But it doesn't cause you to wait so long because in investing, if you wait too long, you miss stuff. And so I think a lot of what we do with our business owner clients is we put this process in place and they say, wow, Sten, you've saved me so much because of the things we said no to. Even if they feel good, we want to pass on good and we want to wait for great.
Very good. Great advice.
So how's the process going so far with the electrical contracting company? As you hear everything I just said there, which one of those kind of jumped out the most?
Are you interviewing me now?
A little bit. I'm curious what got triggered in you.
Yeah, as I build businesses for a living, so thinking through all that, the risk is fairly minimal. I'll get it at fairly low dollar amount, something I can pretty easily afford. I know construction fairly well, even though I don't know electrical. I have lots of electrical or construction clients, so it's I'm connected to them. So future business is high. So that goes to the multiple or how can I multiply this? Taxes, fees, those are more unknown than known. The time is a really good question. I have a very full calendar with all the companies I help run now. So that's a very good question. The operator that I'm partnering with is exceptional at doing ops. I don't know anything about daily ops for an electrical company. So I think I'd probably check off most of them. We have a,
Nice.
yeah. So I think I'd give myself a C plus or a B for your
Okay.
filters.
That's good.
Let's
Yeah,
go. Let's go.
I love the trade space. Like that, those are such
Yeah,
in-demand businesses.
for sure.
Another thing I wish I would have known sooner is that the type of people that book Who Not How, that I think I was overconfident in my own abilities until I realized like I have limitations.
Yeah.
And it then comes down to, do I have studs around me to help execute on the things? If I sit in the visionary seat, like it sounds like you sit in the visionary seat, it's,
I do.
You don't need five visionaries around you, but you need executors,
For
like
sure.
organized project manager type people. And I think in the past, I would get people pumped up and they would follow me. And then I'd look around, I'd realize everybody's on my back. And I'm like, I can't do this forever. And I think it's hard as an entrepreneur when you get good at looking and finding great opportunities. And you have to realize that's a great one I have to pass on. That's a great one I have to pass on because I just don't have the capacity to take on anything else.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, no, I need executors for sure. Great operators. So you were recognized 40 Under 40 Award for top advisors in the country by Investors News, and you wrote a book, Seven Mindsets of Success. I would love to hear from you the top one, two, three mindsets that help people. You're a high achiever, you're a go-getter. What are the mindsets in yourself and the other highly successful people?
So I wrote that book when I was 28. I got the 40 Under 40 award at 30. So I squeaked in. They said, I think I might have been the youngest one to get it. And at 28, I think I saw some things a certain way. I think, you know, from 28 to 38, 38 now, God's helped redefine a lot of those lessons. So many of them are still true. I think as life beats you up, I think like the depth of understanding of those it changes. And so that book could maybe be five times as long now as I just unpack real life scenarios.
I'm very curious at what's changed now for sure.
And so, for example, one of them is future self. Like from a very early age, just I think this is part of my story. Like I had a very direct connection to like what would Sten 10 years from now if I sat down with him? Would he be proud or frustrated with the decisions I'm making? And somehow that like just it drove me to not have regret. And so I think that was a big driver. And the subtitle of the book, wish I knew that sooner, like how to avoid financial regret. None of us like that feeling. And we're all going to have regret, but if we can limit it at the end of the day, what steps can we take? And so the future self one has, I think in my 20s, that was more based off of like performance and like shame driven towards don't mess up, be the best version of yourself. And I was just too tough of a critic. And some of the counseling and these retreats I've done, I get around these other successful business owners, like so many of us, like our trauma drives us. The thing we all need to resolve is also the thing that gives us fire. And in the workplace, you're like celebrated for it. And then personally, this could be with your family, your marriage, your kids, it gets in the way. And it's weird to reconcile that where you're like, wait,
True.
the world loves what I'm doing here, yet it's not helping me or serving me in this part of my life.
Good.
And so I think a future self mindset for me is if you're listening, you're like, I have a hard time finding motivation to do stuff. Sitting down, journaling helps with this, and really trying to connect to does the future wiser version of me, am I proud of the stuff I'm doing now, of the discipline, or am I on my phone too much? Am I choosing not to work out in the morning? And I almost know that if my future self was sitting here, they'd be like, what are you doing? Do us a favor and help us out. So that was a big one that still drives me a lot.
Yeah, I agree.
I think perspective is another mindset of which to me speaks to awareness. The most successful people I know are the most aware of themselves, for better or worse. That's just being raw and real. I do have these flaws. I tend to react this way in these situations. I spent a lot of time in my 20s trying to excuse that stuff away or push back on the truth of who I am. Still to this day, if you throw me in a pickup basketball league, like there's a chance I try to throw down with the passer. Like there's a fire in me and it's okay. So I don't want to, and those games are always great when you almost go to blows with everybody. But there's like, all right, God gave me something inside of me that's like this intense passion, but I need to channel it really well. I could argue with somebody like, no, that's not true. Or I could give you reasons why I do what I'm doing. Or I can say, okay, how do I channel this the best way? Leading more with curiosity than defensiveness is something I've really had to learn to do well. So yeah, those are two biggest ones I'd say have helped me a lot.
I like the future self. I was a guest on a podcast last week and I was asked because I come from a broken, dysfunctional, alcoholic, angry home and grew up in poverty and just a mindset that I didn't want. And so the host asked me, H, how have you changed your mindset? And I've coached and counseled literally thousands of people. And I said, early in my career, I would answer that question and say, I don't really know. I just made a decision to not perpetuate the cycle that I had. So I didn't really know. But the more I've interrogated it, I've come to this kind of semi-conclusion about mindset. And tell me what you think about this. And what I said was, until someone falls in love with a better future version of themselves than their status quo, they're not going to change. They have to love that future version of their self or their reality. They have to love that more than they love whatever they're sitting in right now, whether it's mediocrity or addiction or divorce or whatever it is. They have to fall in love with that future self more than they are attached to this current status quo. Agree or disagree?
Totally agree. Yeah, I think the idea that like the cost of inaction becomes greater than the pain of change. I've heard it put that way before. One thing I've, and this helped me to frame it this way, there's resistance in all of our lives, a force that's stopping us from trying to do the things we know we want to do. Because I've said with so many business owners and professionals, like it's not the desire that's lacking. Like we all want to live healthy lives, show up for our kids, have great marriages. Like I haven't met many people that are like, I don't want those things. Like I'm intentionally and purposely waking up and taking a different path that I know is wrong because I want to. I don't think that's the case. What I have learned, and this is true of me, is there's resistance. And resistance, it helped when I actually put a face to it that I was like, I think this is the thing I'm battling every day. And I think we all face it. I just think some people get better at winning it every day. And this is how I visualize this. I think my mind, if I could have been born in a time, it would have been born like with knights and castles, because I'm like, I just want to just go to battle every day.
Fight all the time.
And where when I wake up, resistance is waiting for me. And its goal that day is for me to not show up. It's for me to hang out on my phone too long. It's to sleep in instead of going to the gym. But the way my mind works is if I know there's like if I can put a face to that thing and I'm like, oh wait, I can win that little battle today. It gamifies it for me a little bit. So when I get in a cold plunge and everything in my body is, don't do this, that's resistance. If I'm like, hey, Sten, it's 3 o'clock, you did a pretty good job, you can probably just clock out early. That's resistance. Like it's sneaky and it's trying to get you to sacrifice and fall short of what you know you want. And so when I coach other advisors or other business owners, I'm like, okay, let's just be aware. Let's call this out that there's a reason all of us don't fail forward, meaning like success doesn't just come to you if you just sit still. Resistance is pushing you back all the time. And so you have to push forward in order to win. So let's just know, agree that this is going to be challenging. And that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, very good.
But if you can beat resistance every day and accept and not complain that it's there, I think those are the people that can take steps forward and push forward, where a lot of people are unaware resistance is the thing pushing them back, unaware that they're in a daily battle, and guaranteeing these regrets are going to come.
It brings up a question for me then. You've coached and mentored many professionals. What maybe one belief or behavior do you see consistently holding people back?
For a lot of the people I get to interact with, it's really this like curse of comfort. It's this feeling of I'm doing good enough. I think I'm fine. Instead of what is the full potential like the Lord has for me, and am I pursuing that? And that's where resistance can get really sneaky. And when I coach financial advisors across the country, I'm meeting them. Some that are making a few hundred grand a year, up to $1 million a year, and I'm looking at them. I'm like you've been tricked into thinking you've done it. Like you're done. And if it's based on how much money you're making each year, like good job, maybe you have, but there's a blind spot around I've been tricked into thinking I finished the race when there's so much more meaningful things to do. I'm just maybe not willing to deviate from what I know to be true in the comfort of that in order to step into something else. And part of that with my companies is at 30, I had received an award where most people would say, Sten, you did a good job. Like you could almost retire at this point. Your business is as healthy, like everything's great. I then shifted to, I started another business, which was coaching other financial advisors, which forced me to think differently about how I communicate, what content I create. And then we're also building Legacy, which is our financial planning firm. There's a curiosity in me of what's the next skill I can learn that's going to help me be ready when I am called to do whatever I need to do to help others to serve the kingdom. And so for me, I get frustrated when I see people that are just in cruise control because I'm like, man, you are a day or a step away from a new lesson that is going to change the way you see the world. But you have to be willing to agree that what got you here is not going to get you there. And instead of fighting that, it's in order to level up, in order to go from warrior to sage to king, whatever that it's, you have to say, that was great. I'm proud of it. Thank you for all of that. But now I'm stepping into something new. It's like almost being willing to be a beginner in something else again. And I don't think most people want to do that.
Why don't they? What stops them at whatever stage?
I think fear. I think it takes courage
Yeah.
to say, hey, I think I figured this out. But for me personally, like in my businesses, when I realized that the growing up with a single mom and three sisters and telling myself at some age, hey, your purpose in life is to take care of everybody else. And someday when you were in heaven and sitting there, the more difficult your life was, the prouder God is going to be of you. That was the narrative I lived my life off of,
Interesting.
which to a lot of people was awesome because they're like, this is great. Sten works really hard. He blesses all of us. Let's not ever let that change. But it wasn't filling me up. I didn't have good boundaries for myself. And so I had to, in a healthy way, say, I'm going to have to totally disrupt and break apart this thing that so many people are saying is actually a good thing. I'm getting awards for it. People around me are happy. It seems like I have friends, but it wasn't sustainable or healthy for me. The ripple effect that took place over the next few years after I said, I have to break this system down was brutal. People you thought were friends were actually not friends. People that were family were like, wait, they were just here because it was great for them, but actually this isn't a reciprocal relationship. It's very one-sided.
Sure.
And I almost wasn't, I think, emotionally ready for all that too. Like physically I could bear through it all, but I think the shame, the guilt, like all the feeling stuff that came with that, like I had to learn a lot on the fly to be able to sit in all those emotions and realize, yeah, that person could be upset at me because I'm not paying their rent anymore. And that's okay. I'm not going to try to convince them not to be mad at me. They're allowed to do that, but I'm also not going to internalize it and let it drive me. So I think it's at times the fear of the unknown about what's about to happen. And it's tough because you never know how difficult it can be once you make that next choice of this was working, but I'm going to take a different path. For me, it's just believing like God has equipped me to handle whatever's coming next. So I'm letting fear drive me less.
If you're going to put a chapter title on that painful lesson, how would you summarize that? You talked about boundaries, you talked about relationships that were one-sided. You talked about just yourself learning your own purpose wasn't necessarily to carry the weight of all these people. How would you title that if you were to sum it up?
To me, what comes to mind is limitations. I
Okay.
think if I can admit my humanness and limitations, like, of course I can't do all of that. If I think too highly of myself, that's where I actually think, hey, maybe I can pull this thing off. But I think that's where life and the Lord have brought me to where it's, you put me in the right room with the right people, like I have some skills and I'll blow your mind, but I can't be all things to all people all the time. And then understanding myself better of my own internal emotions and things, like there's no way I can control that in everybody else. I think I'm strong enough to observe it. But yeah, I think there's a big part of knowing your own limitations.
It sounds like what I'm hearing is as you're nearing middle age, maybe getting wiser, maybe more humble, some of those thoughts at 28, at near 40, maybe you're changing. What is that? A, is that true or false? And how do you see yourself getting wiser and maybe softer and, just wiser and softer, maybe soft. Interpret that however you want.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I don't think people would use the word soft to describe me yet.
That's what I figured,
But I know what you're saying. I still think I have an intensity, but I think it's balanced with a lot more curiosity now. I think at growing up in the unpredictable environment I did, I think some part of me had to say, no, this is more defined than I think it is because that just gives me more control. And even though it was always somewhat out of my control. If I convinced myself that I had more control than I did, I think that helped me cope. Because people were making decisions all the time around me when I was young that I had no control over that dramatically affected my life. And you're sitting there like, no one cares. No one's considering me. So I think some part of the protectionist side of me was like, Sten, you got this. If you, as long as you X, Y, and Z, you're going to get the outcome you want. Like I just had to have it be a little more structured. And then getting older and realizing it never was structured. People were always unpredictable. But now I think I'm better able to handle it. I think I can sit in the chaos better at this point. But so much of it is curiosity. I think that's something when I coach people up on, I'm like, there's probably always room for three questions before you come out with something. Like you're missing something. Questions help create connections with somebody else. But I still have this feeling of I don't want to lose the fire. Like I don't. And part of that was when I played sports and I was so intense to a fault. I remember I would struggle with coaches because coaches would be like, "Sten, you can't do that during a game." And I'm like, but that's why you have me in the game. That's the reason nobody wants to play against us is because like we bring this intensity. But that same intensity could be channeled at the right time in a kind way without yelling at the refs. Like there's a way of doing it. And so in business now as a leader, I'm like, how do I lead with curiosity, but still hold a really high bar?
Yeah, very good.
And I've had people join our companies and then me say, "Hey, you were on path for a while and now you've stalled out. Here's the plan." And they just didn't want to level up. And multiple times they've said, "I've accomplished things I never thought I could by working with you." And I was like, "Well, thank you for that. I wish you would have kept leveling up. This is a hard conversation. But is there a way where people, even if you have hard conversations with them, can still respect you and speak kindly of you?" And I think that's the leader I want to try to be. Not that Sten's really nice. Great book called Not Nice. When I read that book, I'm like, wow, people have been following me for my entire life. That you can be kind to people, but even kind bosses let people go.
Sure.
Nice bosses keep people way too long because they care about what they think of them too much. And then they hurt everybody. And yeah, I think there's I hope people would say now, Sten is much more curious. He's intentional, but he's still intense. And I think that's a season that I'm in now.
Intentional, but still intense. I like that. You have another book called Value First Prospecting. I'm curious. I think we understand what that means. I'm really curious not only how that applies to potential clients, which I think is fairly obvious. How do you apply that? Like all the leaders are listening, I'm curious, how can we apply that inside our organizations as well as outside?
Yeah, that book was a shot over the bow to the financial planning industry
Yeah.
because it's such a sales-focused business. And I feel like there's this trust gap, meaning, and this was the script. So I'd meet as HR, let's assume you got referred to me to be your financial advisor, and you already have a financial advisor.
Yeah.
And I would say, "Great to meet you. Hey, I hope you like me a lot. You should transfer your money to me, maybe buy this insurance policy, and just take my word for it. This is going to be good for you." And you'd be like, "That's not very compelling. I have to go. I have a busy life. I got to run to soccer practice right after this. Like what you just put in front of me is only going to work if I have no other options or I'm desperate right now." And so the idea of value first prospecting is I'm going to come with solutions first. I'm going to be generous with you up front to build some trust and rapport. You may then say, "Wait, tell me how you do that." And I'm going to say, "I'd love to. If we get a chance to work together, I'm going to unpack that with you." So I'm still going to have a boundary of you don't get all of my time and energy for free, which a lot of advisors do. They just give away all their time and energy in the hope of selling you something. And what we're coaching people on is that there's a way to be generous with your ideas to create connection and trust. That imagine if the first time I met with you, I gave you some free ideas that paid for myself. That's pretty compelling. And I
Compelling.
said, "Hey, like in 30 minutes, I just gave you two free ideas. You can go do these on your own. But now imagine what I could do if we worked together for the next 3 months." So it's this more value-based conversation versus, "Hey, I think you have a problem. I have a product. Let's see if this thing works out."
Right.
And so I think for leaders, when we think about communication, in my career, the greatest gift I've given myself and probably everybody around me is like pursuing communication skills. I think at times the biggest gap or the obstacle between somebody hearing something and taking action in it is in the way it's presented to them. And so if I'm in a room with you as a client or even a team member and I'm sitting there just talking at you the whole time, there's some disconnect. Like I'm filling in the gaps in my mind and you don't know what I know. And so we're not on the same page. But if I jump up on a whiteboard in that meeting and I say, "Hey, explain this to me," and I start taking notes live with you and I turn it more into a coaching session, I think we almost have to live in that posture all the time. And so even when I'm with a team, like this morning we had a team meeting, I don't sit there the whole meeting just looking at everybody. I stand up and I say, "Wait, explain that to me. Hey, what are you working on this week? What's your obstacle there?" And I'm trying to increase the energy in the room by turning it into a strategy coaching session. And so any leader listening right now, do an audit of yourself and say, how do other people experiencing me when I communicate? Is my energy contagious? Am I asking great questions? And so I think the core of value first prospecting is like, how can you give somebody an experience when they're with you that they don't forget?
Very good.
Because a confused mind says no. And if the way we're communicating or we're unprepared for a meeting, we're probably leaving somebody more confused than they came. And most of the time, people don't take action. And so I try to apply that one to clients, but also to my team members. Do they have clarity around their KPIs? Do they know what the vision is? Do I seem excited? Like, I want them to know, like, I'm excited to be here. Like, the things we're doing are great. And so much of that comes down, like, when we do our live event for financial advisors, it's a 2-day event, we spend probably half of that talking about communication skills. And I'll get some advisors that are making a couple million bucks a year. They've been in the industry for 30 years. And I give them a pen and put them on a whiteboard. And I say, explain that really basic thing to me. 10 minutes in, they've just written like a short essay on the board. And I'm like, Mike, what are you doing? This is a room full of financial advisors and all of us are pulling our hair out. Like, I think we all need to take that skill more seriously.
I like it. I just wrote down in my notes, a confused mind says no. That was the mic drop moment for me. That's fantastic. Stan, let's wrap up with this. Thank you for your time. I always wrap up with future thinking. You're investing in future leaders. That's what Leaders Edge is all about. I know you're about giving back. So I want you to pretend like you're talking to a 20-year-old, 22-year-old, either in college, trade school, getting out of college, you're thinking about preparing for their life, future. You're sitting down with this young lady, this young man. What piece of career advice would you love to pass on to them?
I would tell them that you are your best investment. That before you put money in a 401k, a Roth IRA, buy an insurance policy, have a personal investment plan around yourself. And I've sat in rooms full of 1,000 financial advisors and I've told them the same thing, which to them it's a little shocking. So, like, wait, no, that's what we're supposed to do. I'm like, the return on that mutual fund in the S&P 500 pales in comparison to you developing speaking skills, you developing your own mental health, your physical health. That is the product that you want to be
Love
A
it.
plus all the time.
Love it.
And so, since I live in the investing world, financial planning world, I would tell them that if you think about investing in anything right now, show me your investment plan for your own development.
Love it.
And it
That's
should be aggressive. Your return on that investment is directly proportional to like what you put into it. And it's the idea of if you were a vending machine that every time I put a dollar in, I got $10 back, the only question would be is like, how many dollars can I put in this
I
thing?
get more dollars.
And I don't think people see themselves as that as much.
I love it. I wrote that down as well. Stan, thank you for your time, my friend. I really appreciate it. You're generous, you're kind, you're wise beyond your years, and I know my listeners will gain a lot from what you've shared today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. Great being here.
All right, that's it for today's show. Thank you for joining us on The Leader's Edge. I hope today's conversation inspired you to lead with even greater purpose and impact. Here are my three big takeaways from my conversation with Sten. Number one, you are your best investment. I love when he said that. Even though he's into financial planning, he wants all of us to remember that we are our own best investment. This is fantastic advice. Invest in your growth. Read, get a coach, take a college course, get in shape, work out, invest in yourself. Number two, you are capable of great things. Sten is a very high achiever, a great young leader, and he reminded me that all of us have incredible untapped potential. So, my friend, you are capable of even greater things than you're doing right now. And number three, the mic drop moment for me was when he said, "A confused mind says no." This reminded me of the power of clarity. Be clear in your offerings, be clear in your proposals, be clear in your communication, be clear in your correction, be clear in your parenting, your sales pitches. Focus on outcomes and not features. Be clear to get your yes. All right, if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I'd love a 5-star review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps us reach more leaders just like you. That's the whole point of this podcast, is to reach leaders and raise the leadership bar. Please stay connected with us on social media for behind-the-scenes content, leadership insights, and updates on future episodes. Don't forget to check us out at yourleadersedge.com and follow us at Leaders Edge Podcast on all major platforms. So until next time, keep pushing boundaries, keep leading at the edge. I'm HR Huntsman. We'll see you soon.